Game on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green. I hope you're still tuned in, Jenny, because I know you love a good sports documentary and we'll be talking about one very, very shortly. It's Wednesday, the 24th of February, and this is Game On.
Coming up tonight, we have Greg Allen bringing us the latest from the athletics in Madrid.
Yannick breaks away from the block, three from the right, alongside there is a roof. Also, Berings is going well close here, and it's Yannick, and Yannick takes it.
There is trouble in paradise, and we ask Roddy Forsyth who is next for the Celtic hot seat.
Well, I'm very grateful. You know, there's, again, talk about this durability. They're not a board that just sack managers for the sake of it. You know, we've had great success. We're going through a tough time, but they don't sort of leave you out on the lurch. There's great support here.
Alan Cawley talks to us about the English Premier League, the Champions League, and about his favourite Brazilian.
Who should ban white shorts to Romania?
And Ian McKinley gives us a lowdown on the progress of Italian rugby.
The kick through, excellent vision. They go to the outside, they'll score you. Eduardo Padovani gets the first try in the second half and a bonus point score as well.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM and we would love to hear from you. There was sad news today, Marie, in Irish rugby. Former international tight head Gary Halpin had passed away, age 55. Gary Halpin played in two Rugby World Cups and scored that famous try against New Zealand in 1995. He played most of his career with London Irish and then Harlequins and then went back to play with Leinster, and he'd be fondly missed by everyone. I know certainly on our WhatsApp groups at the moment, everyone reliving some of the stories. He was probably one of these beautiful men that linked the pro era to the amateur era and just had the best of times doing it. And he'd be sadly missed by everyone in the rugby community, especially Kilkenny Rugby Club, who he spent an awful lot of time with. So sad news today, especially when he's so young, but someone that every time he put on a green jersey, went out and gave it his all, and really sad to hear that today.
It's interesting, you know, when you think back of those World Cups that he played in, and his try is one of those ones that I don't think anyone that will have watched them will ever forget, because his character really shone through as well, and it was special.
Absolutely, and look, I think sometimes we do bow down to the other teams, and I think he was, you know, his celebration afterwards, he was leaving everyone know, not today, you know, it was unfortunate that we, in typical Irish fashion, during that period of time, we used to run out of steam. We probably hadn't the ability to stick with teams for long periods of it, but he certainly, and Marie, that try he scored is so hard. Like, he just basically bulldozed over three All Blacks, you know, which you just don't see happening.
Yeah, very, very, very rarely see happening. But there has been some lovely tributes to him today, and like really focusing on his character, his personality, and what good company he was.
100%. And I've heard some of his stories. I've been lucky enough to hear him speak. And just, Marie, he's just a throwback, and it's something we can't lose in rugby. Those kind of gentlemen within the game, the guys that probably look for the bit of fun around it. And you know, when asked about his celebration that time, he was there, you know, I just had enough of the Kiwis looking down at us, and it's kind of good way to look at it. But it is sad news, you know, because he's so young, 55 years of age, with his you know, his family, friends, everyone in the rugby community is kind of feeling it today. So our thoughts are with him, and what a great man.
Absolutely. Now we are going to turn our attention to Tiger Woods, because I think it's fair to say that over the last 24 hours, a lot of time has been spent waiting for news on how he is following his very serious car crash yesterday. The latest reports say that he's awake, responsive and recovering in his hospital room following surgery on the serious injuries to his leg. Ortiz's Greg Allen joins us now. Greg, first of all, a really, really big shock, but it has been wall-to-wall well-wishers for Tiger since the news broke.
Yes, everyone from Mariah Carey to Barack Obama. Why wouldn't you wish him well? I mean, it's all about, at this stage, hoping that he walks well again, let alone gets back to becoming a golfer at the top level. 2020 wasn't his best year, but there's no question about what the big task facing him right now is, and that is managing to walk without impairment, because he's got very serious injuries to his lower right leg. his right tibia and fibula, both bones beneath the knee, are compound fractures. There's a word for it, but I won't try and say it in surgery and orthopedics. But effectively, there are many breaks in at least one of those bones beyond two breaks. So it's hard to know because they haven't said how many pieces that bone was broken in. So it sounds very, very complex. Arguably, I was reading something from an orthopedic surgeon who was making a comment on it today, an orthopedic surgeon called Bill Mallon, who is a former PGA Tour player. And he was saying that arguably it's the injury to his ankle where he said screws and pins put in, which could be the slowest one to recover fully. There's also tissue damage around the bone. The bone, probably his tibia and fibula, by the sounds of things, could well heal and be as strong as ever. But it's those, you know, small areas around the ankle, where the movement is, that is possibly going to be the hardest thing to recover and rehabilitate. And he's 45 now. He's young in orthopedic terms, but he's not young in terms of elite athlete terms. So it's very, very unsure as to what level of recovery he may have. Fingers crossed he'll be able to walk unaided and pretty much freely within a year. I think they're looking at that type of a recovery period first and foremost. And after that, it's gravy, as Tiger would say himself, if he can get any better than that.
One thing that is clear, I think, from the last 24 hours, Greg, is that the world of sports fans, the world of golf fans, they are not ready for a world without Tiger Woods playing golf.
Oh, look, there's nobody to compare with Tiger Woods in the last 25 years. And his career is 25 years old in terms of professional golf. It's almost 25 years old. 1996 October was his first tournament on the PGA Tour. He won the Masters in 1997 by 12 strokes, announced himself as the talent and extraordinary individual that he is as well, because he's far more than a talent. He's a charisma incorporated type of person in golf. 25 years on, you know, he won the Masters in 2019, so we know that he is a big factor still. He didn't have a good 2020, as I alluded to, played nine times when he had one top 10 finish. Towards the end of last year, on the 23rd of December, in fact, he had another surgery on his back, which was a fifth surgery. It wasn't major surgery, but it was to take some fragments away from which were impinging on a nerve. He was almost recovered by it, by the sounds of the way he was speaking at the weekend at the Genesis Invitational, the tournament on the PGA Tour, which he was the host of. And he was in great form in the interview with Jim Nance on CBS. And he was fairly optimistic that he would be back for the Masters. And he was even speaking about possibly playing a warm-up tournament before the Masters. Obviously, that's all gone from the prospect of happening now. But, the world without Tiger Woods in golf, even at 45, would not be the same. And what I will say as well that, you know, even if it took him 2 years to come back, just say he does manage another Herculean comeback. And he comes back at 47 and he starts playing golf well again. You can still play golf into your late 40s. And as we saw from Steve Stricker just a few weeks ago, Stricker, at 53 years of age, had a really good run at winning the Phoenix Open, finishing, I think, tied fourth in the end. But he was right in there until the final day. If Tiger can somehow find a way of standing up and being relatively healthy, I think that it's possible that he will find some sort of reserve, hopefully in the next few days, as he sits in his possible hospital bed, to think, okay, I've made comebacks before, I now face the biggest challenge of my life. And let's hope that is the story, because the game won't be the same if this forces him to retire.
Greg, we're chatting about Pele later on, but we're chatting about superstars here. Tiger isn't just back page news. This is front and centre on every major news line when you look at it. It shows the way he has elevated golf.
Oh, crikey. You know, yeah, sure. Look, we know what happened in 2009. We also know what happened in 2011 with the Memorial Day DUI that he had, which was all over the front page of newspapers. And you know, with all the highs in Tiger Woods' life over the years, there have been these extraordinary lows. I was just commenting to a colleague, can you imagine a Hollywood film on Tiger? How long it would be? How awfully difficult it would be to edit it down to 4 hours, perhaps, you know? You're talking about not even a mini-series, you're talking about a complete box series to get the life of Tiger Woods. I know there's been a documentary about him. That documentary now is suddenly looking a bit dated, and as is the very, very fine book on him. But look, as I said, when you see people like Nick Faldo really saying we're praying for Tiger right now, that really is the way it is around the world. It's I like the fact that Tiger has been far more socially aware of his position in the world of golf since his latest comeback, and he was much more smiley and much more talkative around ordinary tour players. He had for years not necessarily been, you know, the person that was the friendliest on tour. But after his comeback from the 2017 setback that he had with the DUI, he really had become an extremely popular player. Justin Thomas, I think one of the first players to comment yesterday, called him one of my best friends. And, you know, that's something that you love to see, the fact that he is not just an icon of the sport, but someone who has now become a very popular individual outside of the fact that he is one of the greatest golfers of all time, if not the greatest golfer of all time.
Greg, it's one thing coming back from the physical injuries, but mentally not being where you were before. I know he's had those back surgeries, but this is obviously hugely, hugely different in terms of his leg. But do you think he'd be able for that, for the just the sheer battle mentally that he's going to have to deal with?
I think that's the $64,000 question, as they call it. You know, does he want to do this? Does he want to go through all of this again? Or will he just see it as the challenge that is going to be the biggest challenge for him, and that if he's going to get his leg back to 100% or as near as 100% as it can possibly be, as badly injured as it is right now, why not just go all the way and see if he can be somebody who can play in the Masters again? Because there is a great parallel in history for this. Back in 1949, in February 1949, a 36-year-old, albeit, you know, what, 9 years younger than Tiger Woods is right now, Ben Hogan was in an awful car crash in February of 1949. Ben Hogan is still regarded as perhaps one of the three or four most iconic players in the history of the game. And Hogan was driving in his black Cadillac on a road, and a Greyhound bus came across the center line and was coming straight at his car. And Hogan threw himself across his wife, Valerie. In doing so, he saved Valerie from serious injury. He had his pelvis crushed, his collarbone broken, numerous very serious contusions in his leg. 16 months later, he came back and he won the US Open. He came back and he won six more major championships after that extraordinarily serious accident. The limitations on Hogan's ability to play the game were such that he had to wrap his legs in bandages before every time he played golf, certainly serious golf in a tournament, because of the contusions in his leg and the blood flow issues that he had. And he was in pain every time he played. So, I think that Tiger will recognize that whatever Hogan could do, I can do. And a 45-year-old athlete these days, as athletic as Tiger is, might just be something close to the equivalent of a 36-year-old Ben Hogan back in the early 1950s. And I think he might maybe sitting in his hospital bed be thinking of that right now, that if he can come back, so can I.
Greg, we're going to move on to the athletics now, and we obviously wish Tiger all the best. But five of our finalists, or of our finest athletes, were in action this afternoon in Madrid. How do they get on?
Well, before I go into that, I'd like to just speak about Gary Halpin, because Donica mentioned Gary Halpin being, you know, obviously the rugby player that he was, that brilliant try against New Zealand. Gary Halpin was a fine hammer thrower. He competed in the World Championships in Rome in 1987, and I think he was only 22 at the time. He was a hammer thrower of huge ability. He had a personal best of 71 metres 10, which is seventh on the all-time list and has only been surpassed by one hammer thrower in the last 20-odd years, Irish hammer thrower, that is, in the last 20-odd years. Gary was a loss to athletics and a huge boon for rugby. He's one of those few people whose extraordinary talent in sport straddled, you know, two very elite sport that Ireland are particularly good at. And, you know, he's a huge loss to the athletic community, and all you have to do is look at all our message boards in athletics at the moment, and you'll find that. So he's so sadly and sorely missed and so before his time, such entertaining company, a brilliant after-dinner speaker. And then, you know, the idea that he's gone in this horrible time that we're going through, it just is this winter of discontent in sport that we're losing somebody like Gary Halpin.
Absolutely, Greg, it was wrong for me not to mention that, especially when you could see that type of dynamic power when he played rugby. That explosiveness that he brought to hammer throwing was an unbelievable asset to our game.
He must have shown you guys up in the fitness stakes, I'm afraid, back then. As before your time, we'll give you a pass on that.
But I was lucky to know to be around Victor Costello, who is as well had a brilliant career in athletics.
Olympic shot put thrower, yeah?
Yeah, but and training with him, Greg.
Shot putter.
Yeah. But any time you trained with him, you got a lesson in stuff like power, speed. He was just incredible.
Yeah, and really, you know, I can only reiterate the degree to which Gary Halpin is missed in Irish athletics for not just being the character that he was, because he was a real, as you well know, he was an extraordinary, warm, witty, funny character, big personality. And he was exactly that in athletics as well. But anyway, you've asked me about the athletics this afternoon. It's been a great afternoon. Well, we'll talk about Nadia Power first because there's so much light shining on Nadia Power, the 800-meter runner. She was third today in the 800 meters. It was won by Habitam Alemu, who's the world number two this season. And Nadia actually showed great ambition because she really went after the world number two. And she's not really yet in her class, but she bravely really went for it. And she got to about 710, 720 metres, still within three strides of Alemu. And in the last lap, she just tired coming into the home straight and she was passed by Isabel Guerrero. But having said that, still, Nadia hung on to run a time of 2 minutes, 1.55 seconds, which is the second fastest time she has ever run for the distance. And remember, it's only a week ago, this day last week, that she set what was then an Irish record of 2 minutes 00.98. Since then, Shiafra Cleary-Butner has lowered that to 2:00.58. So I think Nadia was hoping to have a go at that record again today, and it just didn't happen for her. But she's got the European Indoor Championships coming up now in just a matter of days, 8 days' time. And we've got this extraordinary tradition in Irish 800-metre running at the moment, which is really exciting. Not just Nadia Power and Shiafra Cleary-Butner, but Georgie Hartigan will also be going to those Europeans with real hopes of making the final. Also today, Louise Shanahan, incidentally, was fourth in 2 minutes 5.62. Leon Reid was in the men's 60 metres, 6.74 seconds. He didn't get out of his heat, but that's within 0.06 of a second, 0.06 of a second of his personal best set of the weekend in Abbottstown. So he goes to the European Indoor Championships in pretty good stead. His main event is 200 metres, so 60 metres is a bit short for him. Also today, we've just seen Andrew Coskren finishing in fifth place in the men's 1500 metres in 3 minutes, 39.61. Andrew Coskren has 3 minutes, 37.20 to his name this indoor season. And he goes to those European indoors with a real chance of making the final. And he ran well today, not quite to the standard of 3:37.20, but anything under 3 minutes and 40 seconds for 1500 metres indoors is pretty much international class. So that was a decent send-off run for him as he goes to the Europeans. But the athlete that I'm most excited about today, because she's a former European junior silver medalist, and she had a terrific career in front of her, Sarah Lavin, when she won that silver medal. And it's taken nearly 8 years for her to get back to where she was, and now she's shooting past where she was. She set two personal bests today in the 60 metres hurdles. In the heat, she ran 8.14 seconds in third place to qualify for the final, and in the final, she was third in 8.13 seconds, a new personal best, and she's beginning to look like a proper international class 60-metre hurdler who has a real chance of possibly making that final in the European indoors. But it's just great to see, because when Sarah Lavin came out onto the scene, it was in the last year of Dervla O'Rourke's career. And there was Sarah winning a silver medal in the European Juniors. And so everybody was pointing to her and saying, oh, there's the new Dervla O'Rourke. And I think that was hard for her. And now she's more than emerged from that. She's now beginning to find her spot in athletics. And it's just great to see an athlete like Sarah Lavin, as honest as the day is long in terms of what she's put into the sport. So she'd go to those European indoors with possibly a chance of making that eight-woman final.
That would be great. And on Sarah Lavin, Greg, I think that she might share the same birthday as Dervla, which probably added to the pressure
no
as
way.
Well. We had her on only a little while ago.
13
Greg
years
Allen,
apart.
Thanks so much, as always, and we will catch up with you soon.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, it was confirmed this morning, although not a surprise, that Neil Lennon had departed his role as manager of Celtic with immediate effect. And I'm delighted to say we are joined on the line by journalist Roddy Forsyth. Roddy, where did it all go wrong?
How much time do we have?
I know.
We can do a documentary series on this. Well, the strange thing is, if you look over the last year, there's an extraordinary transformation, a complete transformation in Old Firm politics and form. Because this time last season, as we were heading into the COVID lockdown, Rangers could not put together back-to-back league wins in this calendar year. They had been in the potential position of being league winners. And by the end, by the time March the 13th, I think it was, that lockdown was imposed, they were 13 points behind Celtic. Then you fast forward to the beginning of this season, Rangers have been remorseless. One defeat in 42 games. They romped through their Europa League section. They're well clear at the top of the league. The only time they put a foot wrong was against St Mirren in the Scottish League Cup quarter-finals. But during that period, Celtic had lost ground in the attempt to win 10 in a row, TIAR as it's called amongst Celtic fans. That was the holy grail for Hoops fans, because if they could win 10 in a row, the likelihood was would be that they would have had bragging rights over Rangers fans for generations to come, and they craved this deeply. And it's not happening. And for a variety of reasons, the summer signings weren't very good. Albion Ejetia looked baffled in many of his appearances. Shane Duffy has had not had the best of fortunes in his private life, his personal life. And that seems to have also carried over onto the field. Vasilis Barkas, a goalkeeper that couldn't command his penalty area. Jeremy Frimpong off as soon as he got the chance in January, despite being a fan's favourite. And don't forget there were off-the-field problems as well that no doubt you know about. Bolly Bolingoli, who... I mean, who during a pandemic decides to take an overnight trip to Spain without telling anybody in his employers and then comes back and doesn't tell MD and doesn't quarantine and then plays against Kilmarnock and caused Celtic all sorts of grief from the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon. And then, of course, they went to Dubai on a warm weather training trip. They had cleared that with the Scottish government. They were observing UEFA travel protocols. But that coincided with an extra lockdown in Scotland. Neil Lennon and Scott Brown were pictured having a beer by the poolside. That didn't go down well, especially not the day after another Old Firm defeat. So you can see there's been an avalanche, more than one avalanche, competing and contending avalanches that merged eventually off the field and on the field. And finally, last weekend, the defeat by Ross County. The second defeat by Ross County this season was finally accounted for Neil Lennon in his second spell as manager.
Rodney, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. But as a player and a coach, Neil Lennon's always given everything for Celtic. Do you think even the timing of it now, to leave them, get someone in place with plenty of time, or to at least have the time to make sure they get the right person?
Well, they showed fairly commendable loyalty, in my view, the board, when they said at the end of November that they would review the position in the new year. Don't forget that Neil Lennon at that stage was about to lead Celtic into a Scottish Cup final, the delayed 2020 Scottish Cup final. And they beat Hearts with their third choice goalkeeper, I might add, which tells you something about the problems he had with selection. But they beat Hearts, and in so doing, they set a record of a fourth consecutive clean sweep of the Scottish Honours, 12 successive trophies, and Neil Lennon became the first player in Scotland to win the treble as a player. He did that under Martin O'Neill. And to win it again as a manager. And they gave him the chance to do that despite the views of the fans, who had expressed them pretty vehemently and at one point violently after that Ross County defeat in the League Cup outside Celtic Park, where objects were thrown at policemen and also at the team coach. So the board, I felt, should be commended for allowing him the chance to put his name in the chronicles. But what was clear was that there is a malaise inside the team. There have been players who plainly didn't want to be there. Odds on Edouard being one in the first half of the season, as Neil Lennon admitted fairly recently. He had been disappointed. Odds on Edouard, that is, had been disappointed at not getting a summer move. And really, he was playing as though he was a part-timer. It looked as though that only half an hour or so of the game was getting his full attention. And when you add that to the likes of Scott Brown, veteran captain, longest-serving Celtic player, but a man who is now at the veteran stage and who hardly ever plays a full game. He's either on for an hour and is substituted or he comes on later. So there were so many ingredients in the team that just weren't working as they should be. Now, that happens sometimes. It's not only the manager's difficulty. It can be the coaching. It can be the input of outside players. It can be the scouting system. But whatever happened, it all came together to create a perfect storm. Yet, at the same point as Neil Lennon and Celtic were making uncharted history.
So what next then? Will there be a mass exodus of players, a rebuilding needed, and who will be doing the job?
Well, first of all, in answer to your question there, that's a certainty. There needs to be a clear out. Probably once the pandemic is over and there's more freedom of movement within football and more opportunity to get rid of players who aren't happy or who don't fit, that will certainly happen. Interestingly for me, the announcement that John Kennedy will be in charge of the team until the end of the season, that gives Celtic breathing space, but it also tells you something about their intentions. For example, throughout this season, Eddie Howe's name has been mentioned so frequently that when I drove past Celtic Park, I expected to see him hanging about the door waiting to get in. I don't know who was punting him, but if he's got an agent that was being paid by the hour, that man must be a millionaire by now. Then Rafa Benitez is another one, but he also is a free agent. So you'd feel if Celtic wanted either Eddie Howe or Rafa Benitez, all they have to do is make the call and they can be in as soon as possible. So that leads me to look at other candidates, one of them notably being Steve Clark, who has reached the status of a national treasure in Scotland, having got the senior men's team to a finals for the first time since 1997. But also, I would keep an eye on Roberto Martinez. Now, he's a good fit for Celtic in a number of ways. First of all, he knows the Scottish scene. He was a former Motherwell player. Secondly, he's in charge of course, the best international team in the world, Belgium, top of the FIFA rankings for the past 3 years. But his assistant, who lives just along the road from where I'm broadcasting to you at the moment, is Sean Maloney, who's kept his house in Glasgow, has a house in Waterloo, so he can execute his Belgian responsibilities. But he's a former Celtic player, 10 years a striker at Celtic Park, and a youth academy graduate with good coaching credentials. So I wouldn't be surprised if Celtic are looking closely. They did approach Roberto Martinez previously, but he was engaged with Belgium. I wouldn't surprise me if he was interested in leaving after the Euro Championships this summer. Likewise, Steve Clark, he would be available after Scotland reached the finals. And Steve knows the Scottish scene very well. One caveat about Steve Clark. When he was a manager at Kilmarnock, where he did exceedingly well, he was involved in a Scottish Cup tie at Ibrox, where he was the subject of sectarian abuse. And afterwards, he said it was like a trip back to the Dark Ages. Rangers apologised for it. But he said, that's why I moved to England. That's why I'm happy. My family was brought up away from here. Now, if he takes charge of Celtic, he can hardly be immune to that. Albeit that one would say that the worst abuse perhaps Neil Lennon has had over a sustained basis would be from Celtic's own support over the last 6 months.
Would Damien Duff be a bit of a stretch?
I would feel that the ones I've named at the moment are the likeliest contenders. Again, those who are free at the moment must be saying, well, I'm interested in Celtic, why aren't Celtic approaching me when there's time to spare at the moment? So as I say, that tends to direct my thinking towards the names I've mentioned to you.
Roddy, boards will make the decisions, but who would they think out of that group fans would warm to, because they're very important in this?
Steve Clark or Martinez-Maloney duo, that would work. I think the Martinez-Maloney combination would work well because Sean Maloney was a Celtic favourite. But Steve Clark did well with Kilmarnock, and when he took over Kilmarnock in 2017 in October, they were bottom of the Scottish Premiership. He guided them to fifth, but with their highest ever points total. Then it was third the following year and into Europe for the first time in 40 years. And one of the interesting facts about Steve Clark is that when he was in charge at Rugby Park, in the calendar year 2018, the only team who amassed more points than Kilmarnock that year in the league were Celtic.
OK, well, it does seem it's a bit of a watch this space kind of story at the moment. Roddy Forsyth, thanks so much for joining us, and we will catch up with you as soon as we have an answer to the question we asked: who will be taking over the Celtic hot seat?
Game on 2FM.
Now, Sam Bennett notched up his first win of the season and the 50th of his career. It's so impressive as he claimed victory in a bunched finish on the fourth stage of the UAE Tour. It was a windy opening day, so he would have been targeting today's stage, a time trial and Tuesday's mountain finish. And the 29-year-old Julie delivered. He prevailed in an exciting sprint finish ahead of David Decker and Caleb Ewan. Bennett now has 20 points on the board in the green jersey race, with Decker leading the way on 43 points. Let's hear how it all played out.
Leads it out inside 200 to go. Pascal Ackerman, Case Paul coming with a run. Bennett's out of it. He's pulled away. Here comes Caleb Mule with a run as well. Bennett's going for glory. It's got to be Bennett. Got to be Bennett. Bennett got it. And for once, I thought for a moment that he wasn't going to be able to get it. But Sam Bennett gets up to get the victory on the line. Time to absolute perfection. And what about that?
Absolutely fantastic, and brilliant commentary there as well.
Oh, super. 50th win for him. And you're right, Marie. The conditions, the wind conditions are just absolutely incredible. You see the suffering they have to go through yesterday, and then to put in a performance like that today, it's incredible from Sam.
Yeah, the timing and power is absolutely incredible. Now we are going to talk about football, and we've Alan Cawley on the line. We actually put Alan Cawley to work for a change. We set Alan a task. Alan, your task was to review the Pele documentary. It hit Netflix yesterday for everyone in the general public. How did you find it?
Marie, I'm always working for you when we're done to watch matches every weekend, so don't ever think I'm not working for you. But yeah, I did have a weekly task this week, and it was one that I absolutely loved, Marie. Obviously, the new documentary was released last night, so I reviewed it, and I did have a watch of it to review it, obviously, and I found it really, really interesting and really good. Now, the latest documentary that I watched throughout lockdown was, of course, the release of the Maradona one, and I absolutely loved that. It blew me away. This one didn't quite blow me away as much, but I still found it very, very interesting, obviously, to look back at the brilliant career that Pele had, because all we ever hear is kind of stuff that you read about or different stories over the years, but you don't see an awful lot of footage, and it was before I was ever born, so I suppose the only superhero I first came across was Maradona, so it's very difficult to get a grasp just how good Pele was, but it certainly highlights particularly the World Cup era that he played in from 58 to 70, and I found it very, very interesting.
There was a lot of layers to it. There was obviously the World Cups that you mentioned there, and his skill and his talent and the player that he was. But there was also the political use of sport, and that became very clear throughout, and the role that Pelé played in Brazilian politics.
Yeah, absolutely, Marie. And that was something, as I said, that I found most interesting because it was something I didn't know about. And of course, there was a military coup in 64 in Brazil, dictatorship. And it was a really, really tough time for Brazilian people because prior to that, from 58 onwards, they were living in a democracy and it was happy times. And Pelé encapsulated all the goodness about Brazil during that time. But they fell on a lot of hardship from 64 onwards. And of course, as you say, Pelé got embroiled in that and there was always political influence put on his shoulders. He never wanted to align himself to any political party, which was good. But the fact that they were under dictatorship, there was always that influence on him. And after the 66 World Cup, he felt as though, he felt from looking at the documentary that he was, in his words, that he was unlucky in the two World Cups in 62 and 66 because he obviously got injured in both of them and he missed out on the full amount of competition. And he said after the 66 one, he wouldn't play in the 1971, but there was major political influence put on him to play in the 1971. But again, looking on it, even though that political influence was there from a governmental thing, he was also putting a lot of pressure on himself in 1970. And the one thing that I took from the documentary was it would have been a travesty had he not played in the 1970 World Cup, Marie, because it was almost like for everything that he achieved up to that in his career, that was his greatest achievement in winning the World Cup in 1970, because there was a lot of critics around at the time. He had fallen out with the manager Saldano. Mario Zagalla, a former teammate of his, took over in 70 and straight away filled him with a lot of confidence. And of course the team were unbelievable with Rivellino and Jairzinho and that famous goal that Carlos Alberto scored in the final as well that everybody remembers, and the team is remembered so fondly too. And I think it was the legacy that he probably wanted himself, but more so that the public wanted to see from him, the fact that he went on and won three World Cups.
Alan, you mentioned it there about the history side of it in Brazil, but the pressure to perform, especially when you know, the documentary goes into the identity of the country and that mongrel kind of concept. Maybe you could tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, I love that phrase, Dunica, the mongrel complex. And there was a lot of journalists obviously interviewed, and one of the journalists was Pele's friend as well. So he spoke really insightfully about obviously the relationship that he had with Pele and also, as you say, the pressure that he came under. But I suppose before Pele, there was this mongrel complex where they were a developing country and they always felt inferior to obviously a lot of other countries. And even the time they got beaten in the 1950 World Cup was seen as a major failure against Uruguay. But the time that they arrived coincided with Pele arriving as well, and he was seen as that great hope for the country, and that they were fully developed at that stage when they went on obviously to win the 58 World Cup and him scoring all the goals in the quarterfinal, the semi-final and the final. And it was almost a sense of, here we are now, we've arrived, not only Pele and the football team but also as a country, that we can go out and we can compete with anyone. And it was brilliant to see that. As I say, I didn't know all these things. You kind of grow up, especially me as a football lover, Dunica, just thinking Brazil were always great. That's the perception. But they went through a lot of hardship until, I suppose, they did have their success. But no better man to have the success with. And it's only really as well, and maybe we're a bit ignorant towards it, and maybe ignorant is too strong a word. It's more so the fact that I say it's a generational thing, that Maradona was the first one because of my age that I came across, and I don't really look back too fondly on Pele because I didn't really know a great deal about when he played, but some of the footage of the goals and the things he was doing was just absolutely incredible as well. And I suppose we don't see enough of that, Dunica, or don't hear about it enough, because you always see footage of Maradona, but it's definitely worth watching even just for that alone.
That's the one thing. I would have actually just loved to have seen a little bit more. I know, obviously, the time that there wasn't that much footage of him, but I'm always so fascinated in what makes people such great athletes and sports players and footballers. I would have just liked to have seen or heard a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and the one thing as well, Marie, even looking at him, aesthetically, he just looks magnificent. Yeah. Almost like you look at the players now and obviously they're all in tip-top shape, every one of them. But maybe back then that wasn't the case. And you certainly look at the old footage and they almost look like old men playing, some of them, you know, with their socks down around the ankles and the shorts. But he just looked magnificent from a young kid at 18 going on all throughout his career. He looked great.
I noticed that in the 1971 when those scenes came on, because I was actually wondering, would he look like he had aged or that he was out of shape or that he wasn't at it? But he didn't at all.
No, not at all. And I think that's, as I say, earlier on when he made the statement that he wasn't going to play after the England World Cup, and there was such failure around Brazil at that time as well because they bowed out so disgracefully, really, in how they performed and Portugal hammering them, really, and him making the statement that he wouldn't play in the 1970 World Cup. It was almost like a personal crusade then after that. And once he did make the decision, even though, as we said, it was influenced by the government at the time, but also he did say that there was a lot of personal pride involved in the fact that he wanted to play. And I think that's the greatest thing that comes out of the documentary. Even though he had a brilliant career and he would have always been remembered as the brilliant player that he was, and that at that stage, had he did bow out and not play in it, he would have won two World Cups, which is a hell of an achievement. But the fact that he won the 1971 and in the style that they won it as well, that's what's remembered so fondly. And the fact that he goes down as the only player to have won three is just an incredible achievement.
Okay, well, Alan Colley's verdict, it is well worth checking out. Mm. Just before we let you go, Alan, there are two Champions League games on tonight, Atalanta and Real Madrid, and Mönchengladbach and Man City both at 8 o'clock. Just a quick prediction.
Yeah, I think Man City, obviously the form that they're in, it's a fairly obvious one, Marie. But I'll go for a surprise in the other one, Atalanta. La Liga are really struggling in the European competitions. We saw Atletico Madrid get beat. Real Sociedad got hammered by Man United last week. Barcelona hammered by PSG. So I'm going to go for Atalanta to put more misery on the La Liga clubs, Marie.
Okay. Alan Colley, thanks so much and we'll talk to you on Friday.
Game on 2FM.
Okay, welcome back to Game On this Saturday, Ireland.
Sorry, Donica, I'm cutting you off there now because I know you're about to go straight into introducing our next guest and he's not here yet.
Isn't he? We lost him somewhere along the line.
So we're going to get him back very, very shortly. But I actually did want to talk to you first about the good news. Well, I think it's good news anyway that France and Scotland is going to go ahead, it looks like, this weekend.
Yeah, I think it's needed, Marie. I think they probably showed in the Autumn Nations Cup that France have strength and depth. So it's unfortunate that their best players can't play, but they have 14 top clubs. So they have an underbelly. They played England in the last match of the Autumn Internationals and pushed them really close with a new 23. So I think if any team could, I think if I was Scotland, I'd be thrilled missing some of the key players, and they've won two games already. So I think it's good for the competition that it goes ahead as well at this weekend. We all chat about player welfare, and it's really hard to put two games, two internationals on the bunks. You're carrying so many knocks. But for those French lads and Scottish guys, to be able to put three in a row would be really, really tough.
It must show a lot of confidence in the whole squad that France have, that they're willing and able to go out and take on Scotland without having all their players.
I wouldn't say that. Like, they should have, if they're talking about building for a World Cup, they've the home World Cup in 2023, and you know they make no bones about saying everything is building towards that. So you want to see how much strength and depth you have. Scotland, though, if I was Scotland, it's really difficult to go to France. And I think what France showed against Ireland is they find a way to win. And I think we mightn't see their best display, but I think we were chatting about that, in the Pelé documentary about the bit of mongrel. I think France have that now under the likes of Sean Edwards. So it's great that it's going ahead. I'm delighted that it's happened and that it hasn't been pushed off just purely for filling the weekend, Marie.
I know, yeah, that's one thing. Well, we do also have a huge Ireland game, and it's interesting. We're going to be chatting to Ian McKinley about it very, very shortly. When Ireland, or when we're looking at Italy and we're a little bit worried about them, that's never a good place to be.
Yeah, and look, I'm looking forward to chatting to Ian about it, because I'll be honest, Marie, sometimes Italy don't get the respect they do, they deserve. Every time I've played against Italy, it has been without doubt one of the most physical games you ever play in. And you rank it up there, I put it on a par with South Africa. You know exactly what's coming, you know you're going to be sore after it. And then the bit that always kills you, after the game everyone kind of goes, oh yeah, you should have done an awful lot better, it was Italy, and they don't give it the respect they deserve. But one man that certainly deserves it is Ian McKinley, and he joins us now. Ian, how are you?
Hiya, Donica. How are you keeping?
We're very good. Yourself? We're all gearing up and looking forward to Saturday. And Ian, we're lucky we get to tug out here with Ruby Walsh, one of our teammates, and one of the byproducts of him being such a competitor is him being completely honest. And he described this as the wooden spoon match last weekend, and that hurt me to hear, but it must also hurt you as an Italian, an Italian international to hear that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it is the reality of the situation, and I suppose the last 5 years for Italian rugby has not been particularly fantastic. And having played in some of those games, it's not a nice feeling, of course. But this game that's coming up, it's definitely a tough one for Andy Farrell. He's come in for a huge amount of criticism, and Italy seems to be, on the up. They've invested a lot in the younger guys, so it'll definitely be, Donica, as you know yourself, no international game is a walkover, but I'm sure Ireland will expect to win.
What are you seeing in this Italian team that's given you that kind of confidence, Ian?
Certainly from an attack side of things, and that's been built on from Mike Cass, who I know is sort of coming in for a lot of stick, but you can definitely see a progression from whenever he took over to coming through now. So there's a lot of youngsters that are in there, particularly Stephen Varney, Paolo Garbisi, 19 and 20 respectively. They could be potentially a wonderful halfback combination for Italy going forward.
Ian, you just mentioned that there, Conor O'Shea went in and he probably left the foundation building blocks with the likes of Steve Aboud, Mike Catt, and now we're probably seeing the reward of that with Italy. You mentioned some of those players now, but they're coming through, much like we're chatting about France, and this is their time.
Yeah, obviously, I mean, it'll take a little while to get used to international speed, but they've certainly in their short career so far have done exceptionally well. So I certainly know from having left Italy, there was a sort of no over 30-year-olds approach. So they're definitely looking towards the future. But I've been saying for the last number of years, Italy do have fantastic players. It's just making sure the structure is right in order for those guys to flourish and have competition. And for example, if Paolo Garavizi, who's the number 10 up and coming, you've then got someone like Tommy Allen, who's been there for 60 plus games and he's still only 27. And that just builds competition. And for any squad, that can only be a good thing.
Ian, obviously, you played 10 all your career and with Italy. What areas do you think they'll be looking at this weekend of Ireland that they can exploit? What would you be looking at if you were looking at Andy Farrell's team thinking, if Italy go out and they execute this, they could get a result?
Yeah, I think even in the couple of games that they've done in the Six Nations, the France and England one, when they've put pace onto the ball, they look really dangerous. I mean, that first try, Monte Ioane's first try in Twickenham, I mean, that if any international team put that together, if the All Blacks put that together, there'd be huge praise for it. So I think it's just looking to play without any fear and play with speed on the ball to put the Irish defence under pressure. And Ireland are under huge pressure. So the closer the scoreline can be for a long period of time, that sort of doubt will, hopefully if an Italian team, creep in and you never know. You never know what can happen. But, Ireland definitely are our favourites.
You mentioned the progress and evolution of the Italian attack there in your earlier answer. This week, Mike Catt faced the media and he said he believes that Ireland's attack will improve. Do you see that it will? Do you think that it will?
Yeah, there's such fine margins. I mean, people talking about, if Hugo Keenan passes the ball, 2 seconds later James Lowe's in and you've I won't say a completely different game, but the picture of the game is different. Mike is someone who definitely, you know, gives responsibility to players, and certainly it'll be up to players to identify overlaps, which I think Ireland have sort of struggled to deal with. So, yeah, it's a tough one. It's a results-based business, and when you're not scoring tries a lot, you know, you're going to come under criticism, and if you're not getting victories under the belt, you know, you're going to come in for even more criticism. But I certainly know that the players would have the backing of Mike in what he's trying to do.
Criticism, though, like, it is coming quite hard at Mike. Do you think it? I know he's not getting the response. You know, he's saying that this attack is going to click. It hasn't yet. Apparently, it is in training. A lot of that is coming out at the camp. But, like, how long does this go on for? How long do you keep putting your faith in him if it isn't happening?
Well, I think it's a collective thing. It doesn't, you know, as players, it doesn't, much like being on the field, you know, a team's performance doesn't solely come down just to one person. If your line out and scrum is not functioning, or your defence, again, like looking at Italy, you can have a good attack structure, but Italy have shipped 50 and 40 points respectively in the first two games. So you just can't win international games like that. So it's definitely a collective buy-in from everyone. But, Mike is definitely a player's coach, and any queries or anything, you know, to have your voice heard, he's definitely very open in that. So, you know, that can be maybe something potentially a bit more different to the previous environment, that maybe it might take time for players to get adjusted to that.
Ian, you mentioned it there, and it's the difference between international rugby, the execution of the small details. And everyone looking at Italy over the years would have said maybe things like unforced errors and discipline would always be things that probably left them down. But this Six Nations, they seem to have strengthened up in that at no end.
Yeah, they have, definitely. But it's not to the you know standard that Italian rugby should be at. And you know, we as former players or as current players definitely know that. And I think the thing that just makes it more difficult is compounding an error on top of an error, which seems to happen more frequently. And like, I even remember, like, playing with Benetton, whenever we resolved situation, games became a lot closer, and then whenever we made a little improvement on that, games turned into victories. So it's really not big margins we're talking about, but at international level, those small little things can make a massive difference.
And just, can you give us an insight into the Italian, you know, psyche when it comes to those moments? Because I've been in those games, and they're always felt like a point where they just felt like it's not going our way today, and you could nearly exploit that. Do you think there's been a change in that, or is that something you would have ever talked about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure whatever went on in an Irish or an English camp is going on in an Italian camp. It's just almost like, you know, whenever Munster had their glory years and Leinster having glory years, you get into a habit of winning. And unfortunately, Italy are in, you know, we're in a situation of being in a period of losing. And it's you get into a habit, and it's an extremely hard thing to break. But I'm convinced that, you know, with these young guys coming through, the more exposure they can get to test level rugby will only benefit Italy in the future, because, as I said, there are exceptional players. I can understand the frustration of 20-plus games losing in Six Nations. That's not easy. And trust me, from a coach's and player's point of view, it's not easy to take. But, you know, I definitely think that things will improve. It's a whole structural thing, you know, rather than the players just going on the field, I would believe.
Are those structures being put in place?
Yeah, definitely there's been an improvement sort of since nearly 10 years ago when I moved over. You know, there's definitely been an improvement. And you can see that with the under-20s, you know, there's been talk about that through the years. You know, Italy have beaten Scotland, Ireland at Junior World Championships and have performed very well at Six Nations level. So they're the guys coming through now, and that can only be beneficial, that can only be positive for Italian rugby and European rugby and world rugby.
You know, I don't want to be negative, but how frustrating is it when you hear players from other nations or ex-players speaking about the relegation side of it? I think the Autumn Nations Cup was good for everyone to see the level of Georgia. Of course, we want more teams playing, but everyone kind of passes the baton on to Italy when it comes to relegation from the Six Nations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand people bringing that up, but I suppose... Me looking at a technical side of things, I still think Italy are superior to Georgia. And even the game that was played, I know this is 2018, we're going a little bit back, but 2018 in Florence, and Italy actually, you know, we should have won by about 30 points, even though it was an 11-point victory at the end. But if you actually go, if people have time, maybe with lockdown, where you go and actually study that game, you know, to a T, you'll actually see a difference in terms of quality and technical ability in a lot of areas. And just unfortunately, again, even with the most recent World Cup, you saw whenever Italy played teams like Canada and these sort of teams, you know, they're winning pretty well, winning by 30, 40 points. It's just that Italy at the moment are competing with teams that are, you know, at the top end of international rugby. Whereas, you know, maybe Ireland in the 90s, you know, had a 12%. Winning record in the whole decade, you know, the other teams they were playing were maybe not at that level, so it's not as obvious. Whereas at the moment, with professionalism and everything, it can be, you know, glaringly obvious. But no, I still definitely think that Italy has a right. Most people think I'm biased, but definitely has a right to be there. And you know, I'm convinced that a victory is close.
And is it very close? Will it be at the weekend?
Hopefully not this weekend, do you?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, Ireland are definitely favourite. I think they've, you know, they've got enough in their team to win. But you know, it won't be easy. But you know, that's international rugby. You don't just rock up and win easy. You still got to grind out teams and all that. But you know, we'll see. You definitely have the Irish side. An Irish team that's under pressure, Italy have a bit more confidence, but just need to keep building.
And just before we finish up, I know you've transitioned into coaching. How are you finding it?
Yeah, obviously not doing much with COVID. I'm up with Ballymena Academy School and Rainey. So Rainey Old Boys just in the AIL. So unfortunately, we haven't had much to do. So I haven't really got my teeth stuck into it yet. But you know, it's a funny world at the moment. So who knows what's around the corner? But we'll just wait and see.
Absolutely. Ian, thanks so much for joining us. I won't wish you luck for this weekend. You know, it would be biased. But we were talking about brilliant documentaries, and I'd recommend your one on Amazon Prime to anyone, an inspiration for everyone within the game and even outside it. And thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks very much for that. Cheers.
Thanks a million. Appreciate that. There is one Europa League game between Tottenham Hotspur and Palace WAC, I think they are. And Spurs are currently leading 4-0.
Oh, there you go. That's nothing to do with Jose, though, is it?
No, I'd say not. And the other two Champions League games are starting at 8 o'clock. Atalanta, Real Madrid and Mönchengladbach.
Game on 2FM.